Exodus 11:1 through 11:10. The 12th talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on June 23, 1996, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1996. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
My goal tonight is to bring us to some kind of stopping point. I'm going to talk about the 10th plague. We've talked about the first 9 plagues in the book of Exodus that God inflicted on the Egyptians in order to force Pharaoh to let the Israelites go. And we've talked about them as coming in triads. They're groups of three. There are three groups of three. And now we've got the one left over, the 10th plague, the death of the firstborn. So I want to talk about that in chapter 11, and then I want to talk about the significance of the plagues as a whole. Some might think that maybe it would have been better to talk about the significance of the plagues as a whole at the beginning, but I'm studying Exodus as we go. I find that I'm a slow learner. It takes me a long time to work this stuff through. There are a lot of things to keep track of, and I also find that I learn best while I'm teaching, while I'm studying for teaching and while I'm teaching. So I've been trying to piece this stuff together as we go along. And it may be true that I'm not the only one that works this stuff through slowly. I'm reading a book called The History of the Jews by Paul Johnson, which is very interesting. And he pointed out that there are some rabbis who devoted their entire lives to studying the Old Testament. And they would study, many of them would study as at least 8 hours a day on the Old Testament for their entire lives. So there may be some others for whom it takes a while for this stuff to click in. But I believe that these stories are valuable in and of themselves, quite apart from whether I can shed light on them. I really do have confidence that these stories are instructive in and of themselves, that there are things that we learn from these stories, and the stories linger in our minds and become food for thought throughout our lives. Now, I realize that just hearing the stories isn't necessarily going to be life-changing, that it's not necessarily going to lead to a better understanding of God and His truth. And that brings me back to some of the rabbis who spent all of that time and yet missed some very basic things that it seems to me are quite clear from Scripture. But these stories do have value to anyone whose ears have been prepared by God to listen to what they do have to say. What I have concluded with respect to the plagues is that they were designed for a very specific purpose, and that was to knock out all of the pillars that held up the entire Egyptian worldview. And I think that I can explain part of that, and we'll come back to that after we look at chapter 11. Okay, chapter 11 in Exodus is a description of that 10th plague, the last plague that God inflicted upon Egypt before Pharaoh was willing to let the Israelites go. If you will recall, where we left off in chapter 10 was that the 9th plague had been darkness. God brought darkness over the whole land of Egypt, and that darkness lasted for 3 days. And at the conclusion of 3 days, the Pharaoh called in Moses and talked to him and asked him to he made his last pitch. He said, "You can go." Let's see, he says, "Only let your flocks and your herds be detained." So you can go, men, women, and children. This is kind of his final offer. But leave your animals here. So he was going to keep that one security deposit that he was requiring. But Moses said, "No, even the animals have to go with us." That is what God is requiring, and that's what we will do. And so Pharaoh said, "In that case, get out of here." His statement in 28, "Go, get away from me. Beware, do not see my face again, for in the day you see my face, you shall die." And Moses' response was, "You are right, I shall never see your face again." Now, what it talks about in chapter 11 appears to be a continuation of that same exchange with Pharaoh. It's a little confusing because the first three verses don't seem to fit in. But as best I can make out, the first three verses seem to be parenthetical. They're describing Moses thinking back over what God had said would happen. Let me read those first three verses. "Now the Lord said to Moses, 'One more plague I will bring on Pharaoh and on Egypt. After that he will let you go from here. When he lets you go, he will surely drive you out from here completely. Speak now in the hearing of the people that each man ask from his neighbor and each woman from her neighbor for articles of silver and articles of gold.' And the Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Furthermore, the man Moses himself was greatly esteemed in the land of Egypt, both in the sight of Pharaoh's servants and in the sight of the people." God had told Moses previously, apparently Moses is thinking back over what God had told him previously. God had hinted that the death of the firstborn in Egypt would be, that they would arrive at that point. He had hinted at that in chapter 4, verse 23. We'll look at it. This was when God was still talking to him in the burning bush. Verse 22, "Then you shall say to Moses, 'Thus says the Lord, Israel is my son, my firstborn. So I said to you, let my son go, that he may serve me. But you have refused to let him go. Behold, I will kill your son, your firstborn.'" So long before the plagues even began, God had hinted to Moses that it would come to the death of Pharaoh's firstborn. So apparently here in verse 1 of chapter 11, Moses is thinking back to that which God had said. And he's thinking back to other things that God had said. God had said that Pharaoh would be put in a position where he would drive the Israelites out of Egypt. That's in chapter 6, verse 1. Reading from there, "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Now you shall see what I will do to the Pharaoh. For under compulsion he shall let them go, and under compulsion he shall drive them out of his land.'" So that too is something that God had said previously. God had also foretold that the Egyptians would come to the place where they sympathized with the Israelites, and that the Israelites were to ask them for money and the Egyptians would give it. In chapter 3, 21 and 22, God predicted that. I'll start with verse 20 of chapter 3. "So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all my miracles, which I shall do in the midst of it, and after that he will let you go. And I will grant this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And it shall be that when you go, you will not go empty-handed. But every woman shall ask of her neighbor and the woman who lives in her house articles of silver and articles of gold and for clothing. And you will put them on your sons and daughters. Thus you will plunder the Egyptians." So these are all things that God had said or hinted at previously. And apparently, as Moses is standing there before Pharaoh the last time, those things are coming back to mind. And then, apparently, he's reflecting on what the situation now looks at like in verse 3. And yes, indeed, God has changed the hearts of the Egyptians, and now they are looking favorably upon the Israelites. And in fact, they have high regard for Moses himself. And that's quite a change from the way things were when the plagues first began. So, as best I can put it together then, these first three verses of chapter 11 are Moses' thoughts as he's standing before Pharaoh, because it seems to pick up in verse 4 with Moses continuing what he has to say to Pharaoh. And let's read through that, starting with verse 4. And Moses said, "Thus says the Lord, about midnight I am going out into the midst of Egypt, and all the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of the Pharaoh who sits on his throne, even to the firstborn of the slave girl who is behind the millstones, and all the firstborn of the cattle as well. Moreover, there shall be a great cry in all the land of Egypt, such as there has not been before, and such as shall never be again. But against any of the sons of Israel, a dog shall not even bark, whether against man or beast, that you may understand how much, or how the Lord makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. And all these your servants will come down to me and bow themselves before me, saying, 'Go out, you and all the people who follow you, and after that I will go out.' And he went out from Pharaoh hot in anger. Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Pharaoh will not listen to you, so that my wonders will be multiplied in the land of Egypt.' And Moses and Aaron performed all these wonders before Pharaoh. Yet the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he did not let the sons of Israel go out of his land." In this speech, then, Moses is proclaiming what the last plague that will be inflicted upon the Egyptians as a whole. And that plague is going to be the death of all of the firstborn without social distinction: Pharaoh's firstborn and slave's firstborn. God isn't going to make a distinction on the basis of one's power or one's wealth. The only distinction that God is going to make is between the people of Egypt and the people of Israel. God is going to once more indicate that the people of Israel are distinct, they're separate, and they enjoy a special grace from God, and they were spared the effects of many of these plagues. The suffering that the Egyptians will undergo will be unprecedented. This is a cry will go out in all the land of Egypt, such as there has not been before and such as shall never be again. You can imagine how devastating it would be to have all of the firstborn. That's going to touch literally every family. Literally everyone will be affected by that kind of a plague. And at the conclusion of that, it says that your servants will come down to me and bow themselves before me, saying, "Go out." It doesn't say that Pharaoh will do that. Apparently, it will be a situation in which his servants have had it. Pharaoh is still stubborn. Pharaoh still does not want to let them go. But his servants who have indicated previously that they had had enough, and they suggested that Pharaoh listen to Moses, now they are going to come to Moses and say, "Go, leave." So they're going to bypass the Pharaoh and ask the Israelites to go. And apparently Pharaoh will acquiesce. Then Moses left in anger, apparently as a result of Pharaoh's stubbornness. And Pharaoh's heart was still hardened, which is setting up more wonders yet to come that God still wants to use to demonstrate his power. Pharaoh's still a tool that God's going to use to act against. So Pharaoh was stubborn right down to the end. Now this seems to be the conclusion then of a section in Exodus that is at least somewhat poetic in nature. It seems to be kind of a unit, this whole description of the plagues. And then it will change gears as we go into chapter 12 and talk about the preparations for the Passover and then talk about the Exodus. So what is this section doing? What's the point? Why did God send these plagues on Egypt? Why did he set up this particular scenario as a way of releasing his people from slavery in Egypt? He could have done it differently. Clearly, he could have done it differently. He could have put all of the Egyptians to sleep or something, and the Israelites walked out. But instead, he sets up this rather elaborate kind of series of plagues to force Pharaoh to let them go. I don't think God would have sent these particular plagues to a different society. That these particular plagues were selected as the ones that would attack the foundations of the Egyptian worldview. Let me see if I can chart out briefly what the Egyptian worldview is. And I think you'll see why these plagues were so appropriate. And this is all stuff that I have gleaned from three books on Egyptian religion. I'm no expert, but this is just what I've been able to put together. Apparently, they did not have a systematic worldview. And one of the books mentioned that the first systematic religious worldview was put together by the Greeks. Prior to the Greeks, none of the ancients had tried to systematize their beliefs. They made no distinction between the natural and the supernatural. For them, it was all divine activity, and there was no need to separate them out and have a different category for that which is supernatural. The world came into being by a divine force, but this divine force was a god of chaos. And the god of chaos created the other gods out of himself. And it's the other gods that were objects of worship by the Egyptians. And it was these other gods, their pantheon, who established order in the universe, in the cosmos. And it was order that the Egyptians were depending upon in order to make their lives stable and prosperous. So there is not the same kind of struggle between the gods and the pantheon, in the Egyptian pantheon, that we see in the Greek pantheon. There's very little struggle between gods within the Egyptian pantheon. For the most part, it's harmony. In the Egyptian eyes, reality is very complex. It's hard to make sense of. And in fact, we can't make sense of it. That's why there's no real point in trying to systematize our religion. Reality is just too complex. How do you explain the fact that the wicked prosper, for instance? And yet sometimes they don't prosper. Sometimes the righteous don't prosper, and sometimes they do. How do you account for those kinds of things? Things that don't make sense. It's hard to figure out how it can all go together. Well, their strategy was to say, we cannot understand the entire complexity. All we can do is understand aspects of the way things are. So they created a mythology, stories that accounted for various features of our existence. But those features, sometimes those mythologies, were contradictory. But in their minds, that's not a problem, because each mythology contains a nugget of truth in it that is preserved by that mythology. It's not that that mythology captures exactly the way reality is. It just captures an insight with respect to reality. So you can have conflicts within your mythology, and it's not a problem. One book called this a multiplicity of approaches. So, for instance, you can have there's a beetle. It's a beetle that rolls the sun across the sky. I guess it's the dung beetle or something that rolls the sun across the sky. So there's that story about accounting for the sun traveling across the sky. And then there was another myth that accounted for the sun going across the sky too. I can't remember what that myth is. But the fact that there are two myths describing it is not a problem to the Egyptians. Both of them are capturing a different truth. And neither of them is really a literal description of what's happening. So, reality is very complex. We can't describe it by a coherent picture. We have to use these varieties of pictures or images in order to understand reality in all of its aspects. That means that the Egyptian worldview is rather impervious to charges of incoherence. You can't look at the Egyptian worldview and say, that's ridiculous, it's incoherent. The Egyptian's going to say, yeah, well, you don't understand it, and I don't either. It's beyond us both. Similarly, there's no heresy in the Egyptian worldview. You can't really be heretical. New mythologies come along and are adopted into the corpus of mythology. The only thing that you can't do is to insist on exclusivity. Did I get all the syllables? You cannot require that everyone worship one god, for instance. There was one pharaoh who tried to do that. Was it Akhenaten? Is that the right one? Someone did. One of the Egyptian pharaohs insisted on monotheism. And he was ousted, and when he was ousted, all of the Egyptian priests rejected all of the innovations that he had made and reverted back to the religion that had been in place before he came to power. So the only thing that was not tolerated was religious intolerance. Now, the Egyptian perspective was that Egypt was uniquely blessed by the gods. And that seemed to be, in fact, the case, that Egypt was uniquely blessed in all of the areas of the ancient Near East. They had a long history of one society being able to live in isolation from any significant challengers to their strength. Egypt came into being in about 2700, and it was many centuries before there were any other countries that could get to Egypt that had any strength to challenge Egypt. So they enjoyed a long and prosperous rule. Their military for much of that time was absolutely unrivaled. And Egyptian culture, as a result, was a celebration of Egyptian supremacy, of Egyptian power, especially social power. They spent much of their energy building huge monuments, the pyramids, for instance, which were monuments to Egypt's ability to organize its power, organize its society, to construct these things, which nobody else around them could possibly have achieved. And their success was to a large extent owed to the fact that they had the Nile River running right down through the land. Egypt actually, it was just this narrow strip of land on both sides of the river. Because if you go further east or west from the Nile, it's desert and can't be farmed. But the strips right beside the Nile were extremely good for farming for a couple of reasons. The Nile flooded every year, and when it flooded, it was, and every year, it's a, relatively speaking, it is a gentle and a predictable flood, as opposed to Mesopotamia, where they were unpredictable and violent. And so you have a completely different worldview developing in Mesopotamia than you have in Egypt. In Egypt, they tended to be predictable and gentle floods. The floodwaters would bring soil deposits from deep in Africa, carry them downstream, and deposit them on the floodplain in Egypt. So every year, Egypt got new topsoil added to their farmland. In other ancient areas, they had to worry about exhausting the soil. By continually farming the same area, you could deplete it of all of its nutrients. In Egypt, they didn't have to worry about it. The topsoil was brought in by the Nile and spread out over the farmlands, and so they enjoyed good crops for the most part, year after year after year. Also, the Nile made it possible for them to irrigate this land. They're living in desert. It didn't rain much there, but they could irrigate, providing water to their crops whenever their crops needed it. So the Nile was an extremely important force in the success of Egypt. Also, they were blessed with long growing seasons in a semi-tropical climate. They had sun most of the year. They were able to grow several crops on land that in our part of the country would only grow one crop. As a result of these factors, they had geographic isolation from some of the surrounding peoples. It was hard for attackers to get to Egypt, for the most part. As a result, they had a very conservative culture, quite different from our own. They would look back at the past and say, the past, what we've done in the past works, don't tinker with it. You don't want to mess with your traditions, because it's those traditions which have provided the stability, and we don't want to mess it up. So for centuries, Egyptian culture was, for the most part, frozen, essentially frozen, and remained unchanged. Now, in this culture, the pharaoh was extremely important. He was seen to be a god, and he was seen to be a god in a way that was different from in Mesopotamian religion. In the Mesopotamian religions, a human being, when he became a king, was elevated to the position of being the son of a god. And he became an intermediary between the human beings and the pantheon. In Egypt, when the pharaoh was born, the understanding was he was born a god. And when he was crowned pharaoh, that was simply making his divinity manifest. Rather than turning him into a god, it's just making the god within him clear to everyone. So he was seen as an equal to the gods, or nearly an equal to the gods. And as a result, in Egyptian art, it is an art form in which the status of a person is indicated by their size on the drawing. And the pharaoh was depicted consistently as being the same size as divinities rather than beings. His word, then, was law. What he said, that's what happened. Louis XIV was famous for his statement in France, "The state is me." In Egypt, they didn't have a word for the state. In Egypt, the pharaoh was the state to an extent that Louis XIV could only dream of. In fact, what Pharaoh said was law, and there were no constraints on him. His job as Pharaoh was to maintain order, to keep things in line, keep things going the way they have been traditionally done. And it was believed that if he could maintain social order within Egypt, then the gods would reciprocate by maintaining order in the natural world. So it was said of Pharaoh that he produced barley. It was said of Pharaoh that he caused the Nile to flood. It was said of Pharaoh that he caused the sun to rise. And he did all this by ruling according to order, that is, according to divine justice, the way things ought to be done. As a side point, one of the books that I read pointed out that a Greek traveler traveling in Egypt, and this would have been in the second or third century BC, remarked that every morning the pharaoh would go to a sacred pool and bathe before the sun rose, and then would come out of the water and adore the sun as it came up, indicating his solidarity with the sun and indicating the role that he was playing in keeping the sun coming up when it's supposed to come up. That's interesting to me in light of something that I commented on in the triads. In the first day of each triad, it told Moses to go and meet Pharaoh as he went down to the waters of the Nile in the morning. And I wonder if the tradition that this Greek was commenting on is not an ancient tradition, and that it is possible that the Pharaoh would go down in the mornings and bathe in the Nile before the sun would rise and then greet the sun as it was coming up. I don't know, but it seems to me that that's plausible. Pharaoh had power over all of society, absolutely everything. He had to have that kind of power in order to control it to the extent that he was required to, so that the natural world would remain in order, remain stable. One of the authors that I read said, Egypt sacrificed liberty for the stable integration of natural forces and society. In other words, they had given up all of their freedom. They had granted Pharaoh complete control over their lives, thinking that by so doing, he could maintain social order and therefore the favor of the gods, and therefore the natural forces would remain under control, remain stable, and that the god of chaos would not be able to take over and interrupt their prosperity. So it's for that prosperity, that security, and that stability that the people of Egypt said, we'll do anything you say, Pharaoh. One of the authors pointed out that no society has ever enjoyed the rule by consent of the ruled, rule by consent of the governed, like Egypt did, which is an interesting comment because we think of that phrase with respect to democracy and not this kind of monarchy. So theoretically, then, Pharaoh's powers were absolutely unlimited. And something that historians have often pointed out is we think of Louis XIV as being absolute rule, that there is the kind of power in a king that we call absolute power. But in fact, monarchies in the West never enjoyed the kinds of power that some of the societies in the East had, because there was always this sense of a higher law that was over the king, that kept his actual powers within certain kinds of constraints. If Louis XIV had said to some noble who had done absolutely nothing, come here, I'm going to put you to death, there would have been a rebellion of some sort. But there were societies in the East where that was not the case, because the identity between the king and God was so close that he wasn't violating any higher law. He was the higher law. And Pharaoh had that kind of unlimited power. As a result, and that was granted by the people, as a result, Egypt had enormous social stability. For over 3,000 years, Egyptian society was intact. That's longer than any other society, any continuous society that we know of. And that's despite enormous burdens of state that were put on the people. They did not rebel. There were no civil rebellions of significance. And I suspect that the Israelites, living there for 430 years, for the most part, are acquiescing to the Pharaoh's power as well. They have, to a large extent, adopted the Egyptian worldview as their own. And my evidence for that is when they go into the desert and things get tough, their tendency is to say, the ways of Egypt were better. I don't think it's an accident that when Moses goes up on the mountaintop and is gone for a long time, that what they do is fashion a golden calf, one of the Egyptian gods. They aren't just making something up. They're drawing upon their past. They're drawing upon what they learned in Egypt. And when things got tough, they reverted back to what worked, or at least seemed to work in Egypt. So the Pharaoh's powers are absolute. His only Achilles heel is when things go bad. As long as things are running smoothly in Egypt, then people are satisfied, people are content that the Pharaoh is indeed controlling the forces of nature, that he does indeed have that kind of power that he's exerting and keeping Egypt prosperous. But when things go bad in Egypt, that calls into question Pharaoh's power. There were very few times when that happened in Egyptian history. There were only a few times, the time when the Hyksos invaded and the times when the Hittites were particularly strong in defeating the Egyptians on Egyptian territory. But even in face of these catastrophes, Egyptian theology, their worldview, did not significantly change for 3,000 years. Okay, how then were these plagues an attack on this worldview? Pharaoh's power was a sham. He couldn't bring the sun up. He couldn't produce barley. He couldn't do any of those things that were attributed to him. In fact, he had no real power. It was all illusion. And yet it was an illusion that the Egyptians were attracted to, because it seemed as long as they did things right, they continued to be prosperous and to have security. So the Egyptians' only real concern is, how are things going for me? Are we doing well? Is food being produced? Do I have a place to live? Do I have the comforts that I require? Truth was not really a live issue. It really wasn't a concern to them. Does Pharaoh have this power or does he not? It was a question that you just don't ask. Everyone just go along. Everyone do what they're required to do. And hopefully things will go smoothly and the forces of chaos will be held in check. So each plague that God sent was a challenge to Pharaoh, saying, show your power. Here's a snake. Here's the staff. He turns it to a snake. You do it. Well, they do it. then Moses' staff eats the staffs, the snakes of the magicians. Turn the Nile to blood, or show that you have control over the Nile. And the magicians could do that. Well, I should point out the significance of magic in the Egyptian religion. The Egyptians believed that the one tool that had been given to human beings in their interaction with the gods was magic. And the people could use magic to manipulate the gods. And they used it for those purposes. So, charms. They would bind gods. They would force gods to do certain kinds of things. They could be used for that purpose. Secret passwords, that kinds of things. You could write out curses on pottery sherds and throw them someplace, and those would be binding on the gods. So magic was very important to the Egyptians. Each plague, then, was a challenge to Pharaoh to say, if you've really got your power, show it. I'm going to destroy the barley. Let's see you protect your barley, etc. It's a lot like the thing that keeps coming to mind is the movie The Wizard of Oz, where the only person that can get him back to Kansas is the Great Oz, and they finally make it to that big hall, and they walk into the hall, and you've got this thundering voice and this huge image up in front of them, and they're all scared to death, and it turns out that it's this man behind the screen pulling all these levers and stuff like that. Pharaoh's like the Oz. And these plagues are God's way of pulling back that curtain and seeing that bald-headed man. Not that there's anything wrong with baldness, but seeing that bald-headed man back there kind of scrambling to control the knobs and buttons. And Pharaoh was, in fact, that bald-headed man. I mean, he had no power when it came down to it. In the face of these plagues, he could do nothing. So the plagues were a demonstration to the people of Egypt, to the Pharaoh himself, and probably most importantly of all, a demonstration to the Israelites, that all of this worldview was bankrupt. It was an illusion. It was wishful thinking. It wasn't reality. And making that transition for the Israelites to saying, no, reality is different than this, was a very difficult transition for them to make. A transition that took at least 40 years. Well, I think I'll stop there and entertain any questions or comments. The Russians built a dam. It was well conceived, well thought out, and they're still trying to clean up the mess.
Explain.
Well, the Russians came and built the Aswan Dam.
Yeah.
And it created a whole myriad of ecological and other problems that Egypt is still trying to recover from. I don't know if the dam is still there or not, but they had not planned it out. They hadn't done good studies to see what would happen when they did this, and it's just created a whole bunch of problems. They're probably sinking more money into their recovery than they received energy and that sort of benefits that they won't plan to receive from it. Yes.
With Cleopatra, how was the queen viewed, and then also what happened after the Israelites left in terms of their history, Egyptian history, in terms of, did they have any more pharaohs?
They continued to have pharaohs, yes.
Were they still God?
It is It is very Cleopatra. When Cleopatra comes along, we're right at the end of. Well, she wasn't even Egyptian. Cleopatra was Greek. But there, we're getting at the end of Egyptian culture. It's not really the same thing at that point. Because Egypt was conquered by the Greeks under Alexander the Great, and one of his generals became they called him Pharaoh, but he was the king of Egypt, and Cleopatra was one of his descendants. Your other question, what happened after the Israelites left? Did they have pharaohs? Yes, they had pharaohs after that. Now, going into greater detail on that is difficult because it is difficult to date when the Exodus occurred. That's the first problem. And the second question is, do we have Egyptian chronology correct? I was watching a video that was provided to me by Ron, which was done by an archaeologist fairly recently, in the last 2 or 3 years, in which he argues that archaeologists have made fundamental errors in putting together the chronology of Egypt. And there are some things, some anomalies, there are things that don't fit together if you accept the given chronology, and he's suggesting a major reworking of it. So it seems to me that it's not clear when the Exodus happened. And I may lay some of that stuff out in a future talk. But Egypt went on, in a sense. Whether there were significant changes after the Israelites left, things that we can see in the historical record of Egypt, I don't know. And one of the reasons I don't know is because we don't know when it happened in Egyptian chronology. Yes?
Can you talk about the Egyptian pantheon? Was there a set of gods like the god of the Nile and a sun god and a whatever? And would the plagues have related specifically to a member of that pantheon? Or do you think it was more general?
I think that it was both. That some of the plagues were targeted for a specific member of the pantheon, and some of the plagues were more generally plagues that affected those elements of nature that were most important to the Egyptians and their well-being. But in particular, one of the main gods of their pantheon is the sun god. Another main god is the god that controls the Nile. Another god was the god of fertility, which was the frog. And those three, I think, were particularly targeted. There's another god that produced barley, Osiris, and he was targeted. So I think some of them were targeted specifically at key members of the pantheon. Gordon?
You mentioned about the secret passwords, the gods and so on. Is that where the masons come into?
I don't know. I don't know if there were other religions that contained that magic, that notion of magic, and passwords as an element of that magic that predate Egypt. I don't know. But magic was in a significant portion of Egyptian religion, and when Egyptian religion becomes faddish in the Greco-Roman world, then you start having passwords and stuff appearing in Greek religious practices. Ron?
This whole series that you've done has been very striking to me. I found it very interesting the way you've talked about the way God dealt with Israel and with Moses and with the Egyptians. And this, the theme that I keep hearing and what you're talking about, and it seems a very important one to me, is if we step back and look at it, what we see is this, we can see it as this tremendous, miraculous exercise of God's power and mercy to deliver Israel from the Egyptians, take them to this great promised land. But if you stop and look at the story as it unfolds itself, you ask the question, why did he do it this way? Why didn't he just put the Egyptians to sleep? That would have been easier in a number of ways, but one way it would have been easier is it would have been easier on the Israelites if he had done that, if he had just said, okay, let's just go. But what's striking is that at the same time that it's clear he has this tremendous salvation in mind for them, this issue, and I think what you've been saying makes a lot of sense, that there's this great educational purpose in the midst of this. You're so locked into the way your world is thinking about things that I'm really going to shake it up here to make sure that you understand how different I am from the way you're thinking. That he's willing to make the process very long and drawn out and difficult for everybody for the sake of that education. And it seems to me that pattern holds up. If you look throughout the Bible, that God's willingness to take the least efficient way to get there for the sake of our education, I think, seems to be a very strong pattern. But just, this is something that's come out of what you've been saying, but it just seems to me worth emphasizing that I don't think that pattern has changed. That our lives could be very much like the Israelites at that spot where they go to Moses and say, we wish you had never come here. You just made things worse. In a sense, our lives as believers, I think we get to, it's not hard to get to a spot where you kind of find yourself thinking, you know, this would have been easier if I had just forgotten this whole thing. But the thing, I mean, at least it's consistent with the character of God as it's revealed in that story and through the Bible, that he has a deeper purpose and he's quite willing to break all sorts of eggs to make the omelet that he's got in mind here, including ours. Mm-hmm.
This seems to be God's way of introducing himself, whether it's to Israel or whether it's to us. And when you can hypothesize, he could zap us too and make that transformation within us so that we see the world differently. But he has chosen not to take that route. Rather, he's chosen to take this lesson by lesson, slow, plodding, painful process. And for whatever reasons, it makes life the way it is, both with its pain and with its richness. He's a strange God that we worship. Yes?
I was wondering, it seems like when you're describing their worldview, it kind of sounds similar to what's going on here now in the world, especially as it relates to monotheism. And I was wondering, are they particular? Are they exclusive in that way, or are there other religions that they'll embrace all other gods and also all other people that believe in many gods, except the one who actually believes in one God?
To have that kind of open-mindedness in religiously was pretty common in the ancient world. The Romans certainly did that. In fact, that was part of their foreign policy, was to make other gods their gods. So that isn't particularly unique. But some of the similarities between the Egyptian religion and some of the things that are happening now struck me as well. I didn't get around to talking about the miracles and whether they were supernatural or natural or what difference does it make. For a variety of reasons, I think you can see why I would be inclined to think that they were natural, that God was using natural events in a timely manner. But in general, are miracles, do they have to be on the basis of the natural laws or not? That's something that I think at some point I'd still like to talk about. But in thinking about that issue, I started reading C.S. Lewis's book, Miracles, which I read when I was in high school and forgot most of it. And so I picked it up and was reading it and was struck again by what a clear thinker C.S. Lewis was. But he was arguing in that book that that some people claim that Christianity is just, in a sense, a natural religion, a default religion. It's just trying to come up with explanations to explain things that are hard to account for. And he goes off from there to say Christianity is far from a natural religion. It's not the kind of thing that someone would be naturally inclined to believe. Rather, if anything is a natural religion, it's pantheism. That whenever you see people left alone to their own devices to come up with a religious response to the world around them, their tendency is to gravitate towards pantheism. And I was thinking about that. There are a lot of things about polytheism that are very similar to pantheism. And could it not be said that our culture, our society, is drifting towards that default religion of pantheism? If that's true, then it shouldn't surprise us that the beliefs of our culture are coming closer to the beliefs of the ancient peoples, the Egyptians. And in fact, Egyptian religion is a topic of study these days. And the Book of the Dead, Egyptian magic. There's a sense in which they fit with the direction that we're going right now.
Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the remainder of this talk.